Okay, let me thank the conference organizers for inviting me to this wonderful place. And I was asked to give a talk on numerical methods for stellar radiation feedback, and especially I will talk about ray tracing and flux-limited diffusion. We had already another talk on numerical methods for radiation feedback, and I will first put my talk into context of this. We had it on Tuesday. So Shane Davis has presented some really interesting results by comparing the flux-limited diffusion approximation versus the variable Eddington tensor. They used a short characteristic version for that. And most importantly, they're applying this for ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. So they were mostly interested in the thermal radiation field. So they started, for instance, the initial condition for this kind of setup was about 18 Kelvin. In this talk now, I will also compare flux-limited diffusion but versus ray tracing, and most importantly, for the stellar radiation feedback. So we are mostly interested in the star formation process itself. So let me start with only a few equations just to see, what the approximations done in the different methods really are. So for the ray tracing, let's start with the radiation transport equation. And the only thing I will mention here from this is that directly from the definitions of the radiated flux and from the definition of the radiation energy density, you can directly get the flux energy relation, which means how is the radiated flux connected to the radiation energy density. And you see that this is combined by this integral, which for instance has the direction of the intensity of the radiation field in it. And in the flux-limited diffusion approximation, what does it mean? You start, of course, with the same radiation transport equation. But the first thing you do, so the first approximation, is that you are trying to do a locally isotropic. So that means you're computing mean angular values. You're integrating over the full solid angle. We're integrating this function above over the full solid angle omega. You end up with this equation. This equation is just a conservation equation. It just tells you that the radiation energy density at each point in your local domain should change with time if there's a flux going into the cell or out of the cell. The next approximation is actually the flux-limited diffusion approximation. To solve this equation, you have still two unknowns, and you are now relating the radiative flux to the radiation energy density directly by just assuming that the flux will go where the lowest radiation energy density currently is. And by inserting this approximation into the conservation equation, you end up actually with a diffusion equation. The next approximation, which is not necessarily has to be done, but is currently used in most of the astrophysical radiation hydrodynamics codes, is the Gray approximation. So that means you, instead of solving this equation for different frequency bins, you just solve it for one frequency bin and assume that they all can be treated with the same mean Gray opacity. And what is most important is, if you combine the FLD approximation and the Gray approximation, you end up with a scheme where the opacity is only computed from local conditions. So that means the opacity at each grid cell, let's say it, will be the Planck opacity and the Rutherland opacity, but as a function of the local radiation temperature. And we will come to this, that this is very important when comparing to the ray tracing approach. So our approach is the following, because flux-limited diffusion approximation is known to be fast, much faster than solving the whole radiation transport equation, the whole radiation transport problem with ray tracing. So we are doing both. The starlight we are treating as a ray tracer, so we are solving the ray tracing equations for getting the starlight into the domain, and the thermal emission by dust grains we are treating in the flux-limited diffusion approximation. The only thing I should mention about the scheme is that it's not divided by regions. So it's not that you apply in one region a ray tracer and another region the flux-limited diffusion approximation. But what we are doing is that in the full computational domain, you solve both equations. You calculate two radiation fields. And the total radiation field is just a superposition of the two individual radiation fields. Let me go back. Sorry. It's not working. it's running through the talk. So, what is it still doing? It doesn't stop. So, maybe we can get rid of this. So actually, I wanted to give an outline of the talk, most of it which you have already seen. So we will first, to analyze both methods, we will first run pure radiation transport problems, so no hydrodynamics, just calculate temperatures and so on. Afterwards, we are running some experiments with radiation hydrodynamics. Radiation hydrodynamics, we then can test the feedback of stars due to the radiation impact, and we will analyze the radiative Rayleigh-Taylor instability a little bit. And then, if I have still time, I will go to the science case, which I'm mostly interested in, the formation of massive stars, and especially the radiation pressure problem. So the radiation transport problems we have used are the radiation transport benchmark tests by Pascucci et al. In 2004 and by Pont et al. In 2009. These were radiation benchmark tests which were used to calculate, to check different Monte Carlo schemes and to check different ray tracing schemes against each other. And they assumed a star in the center of the domain, which is in the first benchmark test just the sun. And in the second one, it's solar-like. And the most differences is that the first benchmark test went only from an optical depth of 0.1 up to 100 for 550 nanometer emission. The second benchmark test went to much, much higher optical depths, even up to 1 million. So this radiation transport problem is really much harder to solve. I will show here the results now of three different methods. So of course, the hybrid method, which I've just shown, and then the fluxion diffusion approximation. But as a reference code that we know what for this kind of setup the solution should be, we are using the Monte Carlo code WADAM-C, written by Keith Dolomont, as a reference code. And because in both approximate methods, so in the hybrid method and the FLD method, scattering is not included. So we recomputed this with the Monte Carlo code, also without scattering. So one result for the most optically thin test case, this is only an optical depth of 0.1. You see that the hybrid scheme is accurate up to 3%. This shows the temperature as a function of radius. This is a logarithmic scale, so here it's really close to the inner radius of the disk. And from these differences to the Monte Carlo code, so here I plotted the differences of the Monte Carlo to the Monte Carlo method as also as a function of disk radii. And the F-Fluxion diffusion approximation unfortunately yields a wrong slope of the temperature, as you can see here, as you can clearly see in the plot of the deviations. And we can both understand analytically, because in 1978, we have the analytical formula by Spitzer for how what the temperature should be in an irradiated region. And this estimation is only valid for radii really, really large away from the star. So far away from the star, you see that this analytical estimate directly meets the results of the hybrid scheme and of the Monte Carlo code, of course. And the analytical result we have also computed is if you take the same formula and assume that you have only gray radiation and that the radiation is locally isotropic, then you end up with a standard square root of temperature, a square root of radius slope, which follows the FLD result. So the more, let's say, the reason how to visualize this is exactly the effect of this local opacity. So in this hybrid code, in the ray tracing code, and or in the Monte Carlo method, a dust particle, which is in the optical depth of 0.1 medium directly, directly illuminated, sees all the photons which are arriving from the stellar spectrum towards the dust photon. So the opacity here at this location is computed as a frequency-dependent opacity, or if you're using a gray ray tracing scheme, which would even give you the correct slope, you have to use the Planck opacity with respect to the temperature of the star. The temperature of the star determines the spectrum. In the FLD assumption, at each point in the grid code, you don't know where actually the sources in your domain are. So the opacity here is computed as the Planck mean opacity with the temperature, with the radiation temperature, which is locally there. So in this scheme here, for instance, if you go out 100 AU away from the star, you end up with a temperature of roughly 20 Kelvin, and all photons, the complete stellar spectrum, would be absorbed as they would be 20 Kelvin photons. So no UV photons anymore, no optical light anymore. All photons are absorbed as 20 Kelvin photons. And this gives you the complete difference in the slope then. If we're going to now one of the really optically thick test cases, this is a test case with an optical depth of 10 to 4. Here the hybrid is only accurate up to 46%, but I will have a slide later on that we will see that this is quite a good number if you compare how large is the scatter between the different Monte Carlo codes in the original benchmark test. And one of the problems is that the fluxion diffusion approximation misses the shadowing effect completely. So instead of 46% difference, you get a factor of 3 higher temperature, for instance, at this radius. The reason is already known and has also shown in the talk by Shane Davis on Tuesday already. So if you have a source of radiation energy, like here the star, and you have then a disk, the inner rim of the disk demarks an optically thick radiative barrier. And of course, if you irradiate this stuff, you have with a hybrid and the white tracing with a Monte Carlo code, you will produce a shadow behind this region. But if you do the same with fluxion diffusion, the photons will just diffuse around this barrier and will fill up the region behind it. So this is not really a new result. This is quite known, or should be quite known to the community, that the FLD scheme does not work for shadowing. The reason in the equations, that's why I've started with the first slides, is that in this ray tracing regime, you are ray tracing the flux from one grid cell to the next, and in each grid cell, the flux still has some kind of directional history, so the photons know where they are coming from. And if it's an optically thin medium, which is the case here above the disk, then they will just further travel along the direction. In the FLD method, at each grid point, you will decide in which direction the flux will go just by the gradient of the radiation energy density. So if you have initially even a shadow here, this means a shadow is a region of low radiation energy density. So you have a strong gradient from the atmospheric part to the disk midplane, and the flux will just stream in and fill up this shadow region with radiation. The often stated sentence is that FLD is correcting the optically thin limit. It's correcting the optically thick limit, and you only get problems roughly at a border of tau equal 1. Seems to not work here. The reason is that flux limit diffusion, so the free streaming limit here, works. So the flux is C times E, but the direction is completely wrong. This makes the problem. So it would work. The sentence is correct if you are running only 1D problems. So as a conclusion, we have done this not only for one optically thin and one optically thick part, but for many simulations from 10 to minus 1 up to 10 to 6. And in this plot, you see not only the frequency-dependent hybrid and the FLD method, but also the gray hybrid. This means we are running the ray tracer with gray opacities, and then the FLD method as a second part. And the crosses here now give the deviations of the different Monte Carlo codes and ray tracing codes in the original benchmark test. And here, for instance, you see that the 46% deviation to the WADMC code is not as bad, because the WADMC code has also 50% deviation to all the other Monte Carlo codes. So you see that the different effects which we saw with the irradiation, this long range effect, will take in optically thin regions. In highly optically thick regions, you then get problems with the shadowing effect, and only in between, the frequency dependence is really desired. So here the gray hybrid method and the frequency dependent hybrid methods start to deviate. The reason is just that in the intermediate regime, the disk is optically thick for UV radiation, but it's still optically thin for infrared radiation. And to get this effect into account, we have to do it frequency dependently. So let's now move over to the radiation hydrodynamics. So what I'm mostly interested in is the Eddington limit. So if you go to really massive stars, the luminosity will become so high that even the radiation pressure, or the radiative force, more especially, is higher than the gravitational attraction. So if we have a protostar, and if we have the interstellar medium, and this is directly irradiated, then this dust grain or whatever it is will feel the gravity from the star, and it would also feel the radiative force from the star. If you want to compare both forces, one nice feature is that the density in both equations drops out, and that the radius, that means the distance to the star, drops out. So the only dependent variables in this scenario are then the luminosity and the mass of the star, which are mostly given by your stellar evolution model, and the opacity of the medium. So you need a dust model for that. So the radiative force will then overcome gravity exactly when you fulfill this equation. And this is also known as a generalized Eddington limit. And because the radius has dropped out, this relation is scale-free. Scale-free means if the radiation pressure is higher at some point in your optically thin domain, higher than gravity, it will also be higher than gravity in a larger radius if it's still optically thin. So in the ray tracing, you would now insert in this equation the opacity, either the frequency-dependent opacity or the Planck opacity with respect to the stellar light, and the relation still remains scale-free. If you're doing the fluximate diffusion approximation, you unfortunately enter the Planck mean opacity to the local radiation field. And due to the fact that the star will mostly be the dominant heating source in your environment, the temperature will drop with further distance from the star. And dropping temperature means then also a dropping radiation temperature of your radiation, local radiation field. And this means your opacity goes down as you are moving away from the star. If your opacity moves down, this means that you might be star super Eddington, but at some radius, which you introduce, so the equation is not scale-free anymore, the radiation pressure will become lower than gravitational attraction. And this you can also then, of course, put into a code. So here, we're seeing a star is forming here at the center. This is only the inner parts of a 0.1 parsec core, which collapses. Once the radiation pressure of this massive protostar becomes large enough, the radiation pressure will open a cavity in the polar direction. So this means the gas is just moved to larger radii. And this was computed with a ray tracing method, so especially with our hybrid code. And now we can do exactly the same simulation, same initial parameters, same initial conditions. But instead of solving the stellar feedback with a ray tracing code, we solve the stellar feedback with a fluximate diffusion approximation. And as I said, it's not scale-free anymore. So you have radiation pressure higher than gravity up to a specific scale, and then the gravity takes over again, and the outflow cavity starts to collapse again. So from these simulations, we doubted that massive stars can really accrete a lot of mass due to this so-called radiative Rayleigh-Taylor instability, because this was just artificially introduced into this domain by decreasing the radiation pressure. So connected to this, Shane Davis has, I think he has shown only this kind of simulation, where he showed how the radiative Rayleigh-Taylor instability evolves if you have an Eddington factor of roughly 0.5. That means gravitation is roughly the same as radiation. In fact, it's only 50% of that. But this is only true on the bottom, and he changes the opacity with distance to the lower bottom. So you will increase your Eddington ratio here, perhaps up to 1.5 or 2 or so. 2 not, but less than 1.5, let's say. So another simulation which I have run was with an Eddington ratio with only 0.02. That means gravity is much, much higher than radiation pressure. And of course, in this scale, in this setup, you don't get an instability. Because to get an instability, you need two forces which are roughly the same. If one force dominates, you just get a static solution. And the same is true if you're doing completely the other way around. If you use an Eddington ratio of 2 in such kind of setup, that means the radiation pressure is 2 times the gravitational attraction. I have, unfortunately, not a movie for this, but they've written in the paper that in this case, the shell is just accelerated efficiently and reaches the upper boundary of the domain before the Rayleigh-Taylor instability has time to grow appreciably. So it's a question of time scale. What is faster? Do we have a faster acceleration, or do we have a faster growth of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability? And here we are talking about an Eddington factor of 2. In massive stars, we are talking about an Eddington factor of 100. That means the radiation pressure is 100 times larger than the gravitational attraction. From this point of view, I think there's no way out to get away the Taylor instability in these kinds of accelerated shells. But we have also done this then analytically after running these different simulations. So we can compute the opacities for the FLD schemes and for the ray tracing schemes. So here the FLD1 denotes the opacities used in the Krummert et al. 2009 paper. And the FLD2 is our Kuiper et al. 2010 paper. But you also compute, of course, the opacity for our hybrid scheme, which is here denoted as a ray tracing approach. And comparing this to the solid line, which demarks gravity. And as you can see, the FLD routines always stay around the gravitational attraction. That means you are starting to grow a cavity. It will stop at some point because it doesn't feel any acceleration anymore because gravitational attraction is the same as radiation pressure. And if you store this boundary for a long time, then the Rayleigh-Taylor instability at some point when you reach a time scale for that just kicks in. But if you further accelerate this cavity by a factor of 100 higher radiation pressure, you will accelerate the outflow cavity to much larger radii, let's say to 0.1 parsec, where it then interacts with the stellar cluster environment. So my scientific application is, of course, we want to form massive stars, and we want to get rid of the radiation pressure problem. So this movie shows a 3D simulation now where we zoom into the collapsing core. The star, the protostar, will form here in a sink cell in the center of the domain. And once the radiation pressure of this protostar is high enough, so that it means higher than gravity, you can start to calculate where the accretion is coming from. And you will first form here an accretion disk around it. And now you can see that the radiation pressure launches an outflow cavity in the bipolar direction. So you will not accrete mass along the bipolar direction anymore. But at the same time, here in the inner part, there's a fast rotating Keplerian accretion disk. And due to the spiral arms in the disk, you get a gravitational torque. This gravitational torque drives angular momentum to larger radii. And that means you're allowed to accrete mass into the inner computational domain. And by this effect, you just can accrete more mass onto your final star. So in this 3D simulation, we had to stop it when the stellar mass had 26 solar masses. That means it has an Eddington ratio of 75. So radiation pressure is already 75 times higher than gravity. It's still accreting due to the fact that the high optical depth of the disk casts a shadow in the longer region. So the accretion flow can come in through the shadow, and the radiation pressure is a decrease in the polar direction. So this is called the flashlight effect and was not found in this kind of simulation. So this is already known since Nakano 1989 invented this idea to overcome the radiation pressure problem. And in fact, we have rerun these kind of simulations. But to get the whole stellar accretion phase into the simulation, we now not do it in 3D, but we go to 2D axial symmetric models. That's the core collapse. And put different core masses, for instance, into the initial condition. So starting from 60 solar mass core masses up to 480. And you can see that this is the accretion rate versus the final or the actual stellar mass, that you can easily form stars which are higher than 55 solar masses, even higher than 120 solar masses. These are the first simulations which have included the radiation pressure feedback in the computations, and which form stars which are far beyond the radiation pressure barrier. So that means not the 1D 40 solar mass radiation pressure barrier or around it, but really more massive stars, even up to the mostly up to the observed upper mass limit of the stars. So here in our 480 solar mass case, the final stellar mass was 140 solar masses. Of course, the 2D approximation also is an approximation. And you have to keep in mind that in these kind of approximations, because the accretion disk is so important to get this flashlight effect, to accrete more mass onto the star, this means once the disk vanishes, you cannot accrete anymore, because the radiation pressure then also takes over in this midplane region. So the assumption by doing it in 2D is that over this time scale we are computing, the accretion disk will be stable. Or I mean, it can fragment, but it should still give an accretion flow towards a star. For instance, if you have an encounter with a stellar cluster, or if you are photoionizing or photoevaporating your disk, then the radiation pressure will take over, and this will give you a final or an upper mass limit of the star. So let me already summarize what I've shown a little bit in pictures. So we have one radiation transport benchmark test to compare the flux and diffusion approximation with this kind of hybrid scheme, and compare this then the hybrid scheme also to the Monte Carlo codes. And we see that in the optically thin regions, and optically thin then means that you have an irradiation of the star, that means you get a long-range effect, then the FLD method misses the temperature slope by using these kind of local opacities. And in the high optical depth region, you get problems with the FLD because you don't get the shadowing of the disk correctly. And only in the intermediate region, you really need frequency dependence. For instance, the gray hybrid approach gets to the same accuracy as a frequency-dependent hybrid if you go to low optical depths, and it merges also if you go to higher optical depths, which should be the case because the frequency dependence should only be important if one part of the spectrum of the star is optically thick and another part of the spectrum of the star is optically thin. So for the radiative stellar feedback, we see that also then the dynamics will change if you either run FLD or if you compute the radiation field with a ray tracing scheme. This is exactly also the same effect as here in the irradiation part. So by having the opacity factor of 100 higher due to this long-range effect, you also get an acceleration or force which is 100 times higher than in the gray FLD case. And finally, for the science case, so it was an outstanding problem since the 70s how a star can accrete more than 40 solar masses. In the 70s, they have won the first 1D radiation hydrodynamical models. And all these models end with stars with 40 solar masses, because then the radiation pressure gets higher than gravity, severely higher than gravity, and just pushes the mass away. Nakano 1989 mentioned that it should be possible to form massive stars if you're going from the 1D approach to the 2D approach, so that you can get a disk. You irradiate your disk, which will heat up, and the re-emitted flux from this disk will then most preferentially only go into the vertical direction, because the optical depth of the atmosphere is much smaller than the optical depth of the accretion disk itself. That means the accretion disk as the accretion flow which runs through the accretion disk encounters less radiative pressure. And actually, we have computed this, and it seems to work. Thanks.
Ralph, comments. To begin with, we thank you for motivating us to include the direct component, and we now have ray trace in Orion and are about to redo our 2009 paper, which of course, and we agree with you, that the force will be increased due to the direct component. So I don't think that Mark and I and company have any problem with that. But I want to make some comments about what you have shown. To begin with, I don't believe you solved the problem of the radiation pressure, because your conditions are quite unrealistic. These are laminar flows, and in fact, the problems that we're dealing with in star formation are highly supersonically turbulent, number one. Number two, the calculations that Shane showed us the other day started with very, very small seeds to the Rayleigh-Taylor instability. And you have to have seeds. You're not going to get a Rayleigh-Taylor instability with a laminar flow. And you and I and you, I and Mark have been around the corner on this one many times. So you've got to drive it with seeds. The seeds that you get in a realistic calculation of the sort that we've done are order one perturbations to start with. So you're already starting in a turbulent flow in the nonlinear, you're outside the linear regime. You're starting with very large scale seeds. So I would say that until we redo our simulations, and we're about to redo it with our ray trace, and again, thank you for motivating us for that, it's unclear, completely unclear, that the really Taylor instability, in fact, will still not be a major physical effect. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that we demonstrated quite clearly 2 to 3 years ago with Andrew Cunningham that the Rayleigh-Taylor instability itself may be moot, because in fact without flows, which we have included and were the first to include outflows in high mass star formation interacting with radiation pressure, the outflows overwhelm even the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities we were getting. They are now irrelevant, and the outflows provide the pressure release through optically thin channels for the radiation to flow and then permit further accretion onto the disk and form the high mass star. So I would say that whether or not the Rayleigh-Taylor instability actually will occur after we include the direct component and still have these very large order one perturbations may become irrelevant because the outflows will do the job and form high mass stars.
Okay, of course, yeah, let me comment on that. Of course, the Rayleigh-Taylor instability, if it sets in such a scenario or not, depends just on the time scales. I mean, if the time scale for the acceleration of the outflow is faster than the time scale for the growth of the instability, the shell will just accelerate and not get unstable in the correct time scale. So you have to get a Rayleigh-Taylor instability time scale which is shorter than the acceleration time scale of the outflow. So in our simulations, which we have compared here, the acceleration time scale is, in the case with ray tracing, a factor of 100 faster, so you get a faster shell, than in the case if you're running the same stuff with gray fluximity diffusion. Here, the time scale are mostly the same as the time scale for the radiation Rayleigh-Taylor. Radiative Rayleigh-Taylor instability, and that means you see the radiative Rayleigh-Taylor instability working in this scenario with the same initial conditions as we have run before. So if you need the seeds, they are included here because you see the result that it gets unstable if you're using the wrong acceleration to get down to the time scale of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Another reason for that is, so I mean, we are not the only group working on that. We have published this result in 2012, and there was a lot of effort to check if we are really correct with our assumption of this of this higher acceleration. So what we said was that the ray tracing cases, the radiation pressure exceeds gravity by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. It's mostly for really massive stars, it's a factor of 100. So then the simulation was repeated, so not hydrodynamically, but they run only the radiation transport. So they start with a star, a disk, and a cavity. And they compute the radiative force, which you get by using either fluximity diffusion approximation, such kind of hybrid approach, or a Monte Carlo radiation transport code. So this is a Monte Carlo radiation transport code from Barbara Ecolano. And they find that the FLD method significantly underestimates the radiation pressure by a factor of 100. So this means the time scale gets underestimated. So if we believe all that, same result by Harris et al. With our hydrodynamics code, if we believe all that, then for this kind of flows, call it laminar or not, the time scales are 100 to 1, let's say, for the acceleration and for the onset of the instability. You are right that if you now include turbulence, the growth rate of the instability will produce a smaller time step. So you will not have a difference of 100. You will reduce it by a factor of a few, let's say. I'm just arguing that you will not get rid of a factor of 100 by including turbulence. But this was
so all right. I promise to be shorter than Richard. So I just wanted to point out, and this is related to the discussion that we were having with Shane earlier about how you compute the Eddington ratio and which opacity you use. So it's a factor of 100 underestimate if you consider radiation with the color temperature of the star. Right, but really the Eddington ratio you want is not the Eddington ratio computed in the first photon absorption length. You want the column averaged Eddington ratio. Right, and that is not a factor of 100. That depends on how much column of material there is, right? Because you get a factor of 100 for the first photon optical depth, but once it's down converted, the FLD is doing the right thing. And so the question is, what's the weighting between that first absorption length and the rest of the column? So you're certainly right that the acceleration is underestimated in FLD, but it's only underestimated by a factor of 100 if the column is one absorption length thick. If the column is, to take an extreme case, a million absorption lengths thick, then the direct radiation force is irrelevant because the momentum flux that's provided is 1/1,000,000th that of gravity. So I just want to make the point that you want, you know, your Eddington ratio is not the same as either Shane's Eddington ratio or our Eddington ratio, and the one that matters is the column averaged, not the value in the first photon absorption length.
I agree, and I've also, I think, make this clear in the talk, that it's only the direct irradiated part, which means up to an optical depth of unity, where you get the severe differences in the opacity. But I can...
How important that is depends on how much stuff there is above that.
Yes. So if you look closer into this kind of simulation, so here you have the flux and diffusion case, and here you have the ray tracing case, and you see the... I'm not sure if you can see the velocity structure, but the velocities are accelerated up to this point and coming down up to this point. This means in the case of gray FLD, because you absorb all photons at the same length scale, because it's gray radiation, so all photons are absorbed in this cavity shell, gravity acts from above, and you get a lot of mass bumped on top of this shell. And at some point, this gets unstable and the mass goes in. If you're doing the same with frequency-dependent radiation transport, and that's where it's set in, so it's about optical depths of unity, you get the different opacities. But the optical depths is a function of frequency. So for the peak frequency of the star, this will be absorbed, so UV radiation, this will be absorbed in the shell. But the photons of longer wavelengths, they will travel through the shell and even accelerate the material on top of this. So if you are running the same with a frequency-dependent ray tracer, you see that you have already accelerated a region up to mostly 2,000 AU, when the growth of the shell is only 1,000 AU.
But for sufficiently high column, that's not right, right? If you put in, suppose you made a column up there, a million grams per square inch.
Okay.
So,
so these kind of simulations, we have one for three different initial scenarios, so with 50 solar masses in the core, with 100 solar masses in the core, with a density profile of R to minus 2, so where you start really steep, and with a density profile of R to minus 1.5. And in all cases, we see that FLD leads the collapse of the scenario, and ray tracing just opens the gap.
I'm not going to. I promise not to. But I wanted to ask, what sets the upper mass limit? We have an upper mass limit of something like 150 solar masses. If we can get around radiation pressure, as far as I know, we can get around the we can get around issues with stellar structure and wind losses. The initial conditions, as far as I know, don't have a mass scale in them. In fact, the only scale I know about is a fragmentation limit in disks that Caitlin Cratter and I pointed out in 2006. Is there anything else to point to that's really distinct?
I think yes. So what one was also mentioned is, of course, if you get the disk really fragmented, so if you vanish your disk, then the radiation pressure would also in this region take over and you stop your accretion onto the massive star. There might be more effects. So one effect might be photoevaporation of disks. So this was studied only for low mass cases so far. This might be really important because, I mean, we are talking about an upper mass limit of stars of, let's say, 150 solar masses. So they have extreme UV radiation, so they have extreme also ionization properties. So the photoevaporation time scale for the star might be the same as the accretion time scale, and then the limit is set by the photoevaporation. Another, which I mentioned, is
only
this.
Only if you're outside the gravitational radius for the.
Yeah. Another, it could be stellar cluster interaction. So if you have an interaction in the stellar cluster, your disk might be just destroyed by a close encounter, and then you cannot accrete anymore.
I must say I'm a bit puzzled by Richard's remarks about how you form a massive star, because just to finish the thought here, this seems like a perfectly good calculation that shows that spiral density waves are pumping in material, removing angular momentum, feeding the star. It doesn't. It's this thing that came up several times. Cold flow is not getting in the way of hot cavities here. And this seems like a perfectly fine mechanism. If you put bipolar outflows in, you know, your guys' work, et cetera, and jets, the magnetic field in there is going to stabilize the disk. So it's not going to fragment particularly into pieces. We know that from many calculations. And the other thing is that magnetic torques, and if you compare the magnetic torques for jets compared to spiral wave torques, which we've done in detail, magnetic torques from the jets will win a bit, you know, by factor two perhaps. But it's not going to be, you know, the spiral wave stuff at this rate will totally do it. So I think this is a plausible case that you're looking at a very valid solution here, not awaiting, you know, clearing the cavity.
What I'm getting at is the solution here, based on initial conditions,
like
that
one exists. Well,
Okay, first I wanted to say that that was a very nice talk. And then I have two questions, maybe one for Mark and then one for you, and you can figure out who wants to answer first. So my first question is, if you're finding that the radiation pressure force is a factor of 100 higher using the directed single absorption, and it's true that there is a high column above that, which would give you an optical depth that is greater than unity. How high would that optical depth have to be before you would catch up to that factor of 100? It seems even in the most optically thick to IR galaxies, such as ARP 220, that the effective optical depth is only a factor of like 10. So it seems like a factor of 100 might overwhelm that. But anyway, once you get out to on a length scale of the UV photon mean free path, it seems that you make that one absorption, and then if you're in the regime where you're optically thick to IR radiation, you're now solving that problem in FLD, which is subject to the same sort of physical problems in terms of the radiation force accelerating the gas in the direction of the gradient of the energy density, which may not be in the correct direction.
Should I comment first?
I can give a very short answer.
Okay.
It's a very simple calculation. Mike Fall and I did it. Chris Messer and I have done it. It's very, very easy. I mean, it's the condition for when does the column overwhelm the direct radiation pressure force is very easy. You're depositing a momentum at a rate L over C. Gravity is depositing momentum in the opposite direction at a rate that depends on the column density, it turns out. It's just G times the column density. You compare those two. If gravity wins, then the direct radiation pressure force can't do anything. If gravity loses, the direct radiation pressure force blows it out. For something with the light to mass ratio of a newborn stellar cluster, the crossover is about 1 gram per square centimeter. Massive stars can have 10 times higher light to mass ratios than a fully sampled IMF. The crossover is 10 grams per square centimeter, roughly, order of magnitude. That's the answer.
Yes, so my answer will come more or less from the simulation results. So to prove that we are really, in this kind of simulations, we are also able to compute the radiation pressure problems, that we can get the Eddington barrier. We have also run all these simulations in a 1D frame, so without forming a disk, just a radial infall. And you can even put 480 solar masses in your initial 0.1 parsec domain. Still, when the radiation pressure of the star gets, when the star gets super Eddington, it will just drag away all the mass. So even the mass of a 480 solar masses within 0.1 parsec seems to be not enough to allow the mass to drag in by ram pressure.
You can't and really get the direction of the flux vector wrong in a 1D.
Yes, of course. No. This is. I mean, this was the answer for your first question, for your scientific question. So how much mass, how much column density do I need to overcome this radiation pressure. And I'm stating that even the 480 solar masses are not enough to drag more mass onto the star. And even 480 solar masses in a 0.1 parsec domain, this is mostly really the observed upper mass limit. So you don't want to start with a 2,000 solar mass core of a 0.1 parsec. So this would be really unrealistic. And the question, of course, what you are right is for our numerical scheme, so the hybrid scheme, which once we have absorbed all stellar photons, we are treating the thermal re-emission in the FLD assumption, then we have to tackle or get away with all the problems which FLD does. One of the severest problem here for the stellar feedback was that you have this local opacity. And this local opacity problem is not as severe in the thermal radiation limit. That's why, for instance, Shane Davis, which used the variable Enneken tensor, gets this accurate result. Of course, they are also using local opacities, but in the thermal radiation domain, this is okay. What you mentioned is FLD still gives you the wrong direction for the thermal radiation, and that's completely correct. So at some points, we don't know if we would like to use a hybrid scheme which uses ray tracing for the star and, for instance, variable Eddington tensor for the thermal radiation field, which would be more accurate than using FLD. We are using FLD mostly for getting the disk properties right, to know our accretion rates. The disk properties in the radiation transport are given by the cooling timescale which you want to compute. And the cooling timescale is even not so bad with FLD because it will mostly cool through the atmosphere, and this is a 1D problem. But for instance, we see, what I have shown in the radiation transport simulations, the severest difference of our results we get at the larger radius of the disk. This is exactly this radius where the optically thick disk becomes optically thin into the radial direction again for infrared light. So then my assumption that all the cooling goes into the 1D epoxy, goes into the 1D case doesn't work anymore. So now you cool also in the radial direction, and then the flux limit diffusion solver, which we use there, produces the wrongest error with this 50% difference.
Okay, I think we should thank Rolf again. We are supposed to have a discussion session on numerical methods now. We still have 12 minutes left. I had thought we would probably need some slides to motivate that. I'm clearly wrong. There's plenty of discussion already, but I still have one or two slides here. Let me just take 1 minute to show them. So I thought it was useful to, first of all, point out that I think there's sort of two kinds of simulations that people have been talking about at this meeting. And they're really quite different. One involves large-scale simulations of galaxies or cosmological volumes in which there are subgrid models added by necessity because, as many speakers have pointed out, you're just not going to resolve the small-scale physics. The other is a completely different kind of experiment where you're just trying to solve the fundamental equations to study some physical process. And I think the uncertainty in the former is really related to the recipes for the subgrid model. Rather than numerical algorithms per se. So maybe for this session, I think this meeting will discuss recipes fruitfully for the next few months. It's probably in the next 11 minutes we're not going to figure out what the best subgrid models are. But I also would say, and I would assert, that there's really no excuse for getting the second problem wrong. We're trying to solve the fundamental equations. We better get the right answer. So whether it be MHD or rate of transfer or cosmic rays, you know, that's a well-posed problem for which we think we know the dynamical equations, and so that's a problem for numerical methods to make sure that we're using methods that get the right answer for those problems. So what sort of questions might we discuss in the next 10 minutes? What physics do we think needs better algorithms? I would say the major ingredients are hydro and MHD, radiation transfer, and cosmic rays. Which of those do people think are in good shape, and which do you think need more development? Are there better test problems of what people have been using to try to validate methods? And then finally, these small-scale physics experiments are supposed to provide subgrid models for the large-scale simulations. Are there experiments that are crying out to be done so that we could build better subgrid models? I think these might be things to think about, not only for this program, but might also stimulate some discussion. So people have some ideas or points they want to make? Patrick.
Feel free to ignore what I say.
Yeah.
No, no. Actually, can you come back to the previous slide? Yeah. I wish it would be as easy, and I would like to agree with your point too. But there is still a major difficulty, which is the limited range of the limited size of computation of numerical simulations. And when we are dealing with turbulence, we know that the Reynolds number and the Planck number we can achieve are ridiculously low, at least by a factor of 10 to the 3. And therefore, the question pops up whether we should try, as it is done in other fields, to have actually some subgrid modeling for processes which are fundamental, but we have not the power to describe.
I mean, this is a good point of discussion. I mean, I disagree. I think that we can reach Reynolds numbers that are already high enough to capture a decent dynamic range in turbulence. If this is not the case, we might as well all pack up and go home, because there's nothing we're going to be able to do that's going to be able to model anything numerically. But I mean, I think that there's plenty of examples of modeling turbulence numerically at of course, high enough Reynolds numbers. That's important. That you know, we can learn interesting things from it. So,
but for example, for dynamo, I mean, the issue of the Planck number.
I'm sure you're referring to the MRI dynamo, net flux. But I mean, that's a singular case. I mean, if you put in a net field, you're okay as long as you're high enough Reynolds number. I mean, there is a Prandtl number dependence at right around Prandtl number 1 at low Reynolds number. But if you talk to Geoffroy, he says at high Reynolds number, it's fine. So.
I mean, what I'm saying is that in many fields.
I mean, of course, we have to be careful. I agree with you completely that, you know, we can never rest on the laurels and say, oh, the simulation is correct. You always have to keep worrying about these things. Yeah. But I wouldn't give up the ghost yet and say, oh, it's turbulence, it's too hard, we can't do it. I still think that we should be able to do direct simulation of many physical processes and learn things that are important for.
I agree with that.
Anybody else? Aaron.
So this isn't addressing any of your questions, but I wanted to say that I thought a theme of the conference so far was sort of the interplay between different feedback mechanisms, and I think that you know, we've done an okay job of seeing what individual feedback mechanisms can do, and I think, you know, it might be important to start investigating how different feedback mechanisms can interact. For example, we've seen that supernovae can have a very high feedback effect on galactic simulations, but as Steffi showed very clearly, I think, where they occur has sort of a dramatic impact on the outcomes. So, you know, we know that supernovae occur. We know that stars form from molecular clouds, but something has to form the star, and then for, you know, tens of mega years, do something to disperse the GMC before it eventually goes supernova. So, you know, I guess Phil on day one showed some simulations where he was turning things on and off and sort of noticed this, you know, interplay between two or more of these feedback mechanisms will have sort of a nonlinear coupling to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that you know, I would like to push us.
Another way to say it is that bullet two here is hopeless, because there is no such thing as an isolated process, and you have to put everything in at once.
Well, not everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that I would agree with both of you, or something, that the small scale physics experiments have to also include, you know, not just an isolated but perhaps coupled processes. So you can look at them, but you have to look at them in high resolution rather than just hope that the resolution is good enough. So you can still do physics experiments, and you can do them in a controlled way.
Axisymmetric geometry combined feedback effects have been put in since the, I don't know, 80s. I'm
thinking of Teorio Tagle's work, for instance.
Yeah, I think this list is perhaps incomplete. I mean, there's a third class of simulation, which is exactly what you already alluded to, that there might be physical effects, especially in structure formation, that only appear based in the cosmological context. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to construct an isolated physics experiment. We heard already examples for this, so cosmological quenching, or what Avishai, for example, alluded to, the very complex flows that might be inherent, you know, what might be driving the crucial physics actually that regulates galaxy growth. And that's making it then particularly challenging, because you can't nicely and cleanly separate it in the way you sketched here, even though I think this is definitely a very useful way to think about it. And I would also agree that we need more effort in doing some problems right, maybe on small scales.
Good point. Richard?
So, Jim, I think your first two points can be coupled in a very beautiful way, and that may be the path forward for the entire field, because one of the things, as you know, we suffer from, we are trying to solve the fundamental equations directly in point two. And certainly, without slipping to your next slide, but stating it, we already are making moves toward improvements. I think that VET is a major step forward, and we're moving to that. But in basically, what we suffer from in point two is not having adequate initial conditions. And so the way that this can go is by, we haven't done a very good job, I should say, in those of us that are doing step two, in helping improve the subgrid scale models in step one. So as we get to much better simulations in step two, we can inform the subgrid scale models, take them to the next level on the large scale. They can redo their simulations on the large scale, providing us with better initial conditions on step two. And that becomes a loop and an iterative process until the scales can more or less meet. So I think this becomes a paradigm for how to move forward in the field with improving the subgrid scale models, which in turn will improve the initial conditions we need for step two.
Any more comments? Still have a couple of minutes left. So no one wants to talk about radiation transfer, FLD, M1. I thought that would occupy us.
Yeah.
So how about cosmic rays? I mean, maybe we said enough about radiation transfer, but I thought Michael's talk was very interesting, and this seems to be, I put these, I think, in subconsciously in an order of how well these things are in my mind in shape. Sort of, you know, HYDRO and MHD, I think most people would say are in pretty robust shape. I think there's rapid progress in radiation transfer right now, lots of people working on it. I'm confident in the next few years things are going to change very quickly. And cosmic rays, we're just beginning to see people really think about how to do it and do it well. And you know, maybe this is an area for those for, you know, new people getting in the field. Cosmic rays seems like a great thing to be thinking about.
So if I could just take the radiative trend, I think, all right, so certainly on the smaller scales, I think we're doing extremely well on MHD. I think we have solvers now and choices, et cetera, that are certainly constrained transport has provided a means for getting rid of a problem that existed many years ago. There's no excuse now for having monopoles or having to have approximate ways of getting rid of them. If I go to radiative transfer, there are computational breakthroughs that can still be made. And one of them, I believe, really is adaptivity in the angle space. Because that is going to become an increasing issue as we try to apply the best radiative transfer methods we have right now to larger scale structures with a lot of structure in them. And so along the lines of adaptive mesh refinement, one can imagine adaptive angle adaptivity, and that would be a next step forward there. So I think that that's an area, and I agree with you, that still has a lot of room to actually have improvement.
Romain.
Maybe something that was not discussed too much is even for the hydro MHD part, I mean, that's a question I'm asking. Do we need to move to higher order numerical methods? A lot of people in the fluid dynamic community are really looking into these very high order schemes, like discontinuous Galerkin, you name it. And I know that a few people in our community are trying those, and that's a lot of work.
Yep.
It's very complicated. And is it something we need to start thinking about, especially in the context of coupling to various physical models? Or should we more focus on the physics? Or on cell adaptivity? And so I'm not sure, and clearly the answer is very complex, but I think that's something we haven't really strongly thought about, and I think that's something we should.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that one should always, progress will be continuing to be made in all these areas, and one should always keep adopting better methods. There have been better methods come along. For all, Volker has discussed moving mesh methods. They're now being used quite widely. Discontinuous Galerkin methods are coming more popular, but I think you have to think about what is the weakest link. You know, what thing are we doing the worst at? I mean, by improving the hydro methods by not including cosmic rays, are we still not really, maybe there's a much better improvement by including something that we know is really important, even if we're doing the rest of it not as well as we possibly could. There's always that trade-off to be made, and I think that you have to think about where you can put your energy. You can't do everything, so you have to think about where you're going to put your energy. Okay, Steffi, last comment, I think.
Yeah, just a comment on this note. I think it is very important to actually at least check high-order methods, because it has been shown in the past that the development of instabilities depends on the solver you're using. Like, for example, unsplit solvers do better than split schemes, right? And so since we just discussed the importance of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability and how quickly it develops, and this couples and ties in with hydro and radiative transfer, we should explore that we are actually doing this right.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe on that note, we should pause for beer. And thank you to all the speakers this afternoon.